Good afternoon. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, May 24th, 2021, on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. On our show today, we continue to be in a time of transition as we navigate mask-wearing, distancing, and returning to a more public life. We'll find out how one chef in Bentonville is emerging out of an odd year, and how one art studio in Fayetteville is safely welcoming people back inside. And in just a few minutes, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda reports about Arkansas's first breast milk bank. After today's Ozarks on Here and Now, director Barry Jenkins knew his series The Underground Railroad would be difficult for the largely black cast, so he hired the first ever on-set therapist. We'll meet her and hear how she worked with the team, and stay up to date with the latest news on Here and Now, beginning at 1. The Arkansas Department of Health is adding 6 Arkansas deaths from COVID-19 in combined weekend reporting. There have now been 5,817 fatal cases of the virus in the state. There are 274 new cases of the disease in Arkansas, combining Saturday and Sunday numbers. Hospitalizations increased by 8 this weekend, while the number of active cases down by 19 people compared with late Friday afternoon. Beginning today, masks are optional for people on the University of Arkansas campus who are vaccinated against COVID-19. Masks and social distancing are still requirements for people who are not vaccinated. People who are 14 days past their final dose of vaccine can engage in campus activities without masks and without social distancing, though fully vaccinated people who wish to continue to wear masks and stay at least 6 feet from others are encouraged to do so as well. The university estimates more than 5,000 employees and more than 10,000 students are now vaccinated. Also starting today, Arkansas State Police are participating in a national campaign to encourage drivers to wear a seatbelt. A news release says troopers will be enforcing the federal Click It or Ticket campaign, which will last through Memorial Day holiday and end on June 6. State law requires all occupants in a vehicle to wear a seatbelt. Children under 6 weighing less than 60 pounds are also required to be in a child passenger safety seat. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says in 2019, more than 9,400 people died in crashes when they were not buckled. The April jobs report for Arkansas indicates job gains up more than 5% compared to the April 2020 report, and the number of unemployed down more than 56% when compared to those April 2020 numbers. Talk Business and Politics reports the tourism sector recorded a 47% jobs gain when compared to last April, when the pandemic was firmly taking hold. Arkansas's jobless rate for April, 4.4%. That's unchanged from the March 2021 report and well below the 10% jobless rate of April 2020, when the unemployment rate hit a pandemic high in Arkansas. The Arkansas Razorback softball and baseball teams are continuing their seasons after a successful weekend. The number 6 softball team will host a super regional at Bogle Park beginning Friday after sweeping 3 opponents in Fayetteville this weekend. Arkansas will host number 11 Arizona for a best-of-3 series. Friday's game will be seen on ESPNU. Saturday's game will be shown on ESPN2. Should a third game be necessary on Sunday, that game, too, will be on ESPN2. The winner of the best-of-3 series advances to the College World Series. The top-ranked baseball team heads into this week's SEC tournament in Hoover, Alabama, as the regular season champions of the SEC. Arkansas swept Florida at Baum Stadium this weekend and will receive a first-round bye in the SEC tournament. Arkansas's first game will be at 4:30 Wednesday afternoon against either LSU or Georgia. There is a 30% chance of late-night rain tonight, lows from the mid to upper 60s. Tomorrow, 70% chance of rain, possibly a thunderstorm, with highs around 80. Tuesday night, 50% chance of rain, lows from the mid to upper 60s. This is Ozarks at Large. Arkansas is getting its first breast milk bank thanks to legislators approving a law establishing its creation early this year. The law also establishes a special fund to help support the milk bank, which will be housed at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences in Little Rock. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
The new milk bank will collect donated breast milk from mothers and distribute it to babies in neonatal intensive care units and nurseries across the state. Dr. Misty Vermani, a neonatologist and director of breastfeeding medicine at UAMS and Arkansas Children's Hospital, says it's been her dream for the state to have its very own milk bank. Currently, Arkansas hospitals get donor milk from milk banks in other states.
But when you have one in your state, you get to say that your resources are dedicated to your state first. So if you have a shortage in donor milk or donated milk supply, your state's going to be what gets it as a priority. And then if you have extra, it can go out of state. And so Arkansas has faced points in time where, like, the North Texas Milk Bank said, we don't have enough to supply you. And so then you're scrambling to, like, okay, call Oklahoma, call Wisconsin, call, you know, Michigan, and find somebody else who can send milk.
Representative Aaron Pilkington, a Republican from Knoxville, was the lead sponsor of House Bill 1067, which is now Act 225. In 2019, lawmakers approved legislation he sponsored to establish standards for human breast milk and encourage the development of milk depositories and banks in Arkansas. Pilkington presented HB 1067 to the House Public Health, Welfare, and Labor Committee in February. In addition to the benefits breastfeeding provides to both infants and mothers, Pilkington also discussed how much money could be saved by Arkansas having its own milk bank. UAMS, for example, spends roughly $15,000 a month to obtain donor milk from milk banks in Michigan and North Texas.
Currently, we export over $800,000 in funds to other milk banks across the nation. Not to mention, because of us relying on out-of-state banks, we constantly have a disruption in the flow of milk that we receive, causing crisis-like situations in which we're desperate for milk.
While Arkansas does not yet have a breast milk bank, the state does have three milk depots, including one at Washington Regional Medical Center in Fayetteville, where moms can donate milk that will be sent to milk banks in other states. Dr. Vermani says the milk banks associated with the three Arkansas milk depots have already agreed to turn them over to UAMS, who plans to have regionalized depots throughout the state. The goal is to start with 10 to 15 locations and build on that on an annual basis.
I really want to make sure that we reach all of the rural populations, because asking somebody to drive even 30 miles is a challenge, especially in our state. So, you know, my ultimate goal is to have it with an easy access in the vast majority of larger communities.
In addition to providing donor milk to babies in need across the state, Vermani says she hopes the creation of the milk bank provides her a stepping stone to help more moms breastfeed their own infants.
And if that means then that they have extra milk that they can donate to the milk bank, all the better. But before I can actually have milk that comes into the milk bank, I have to have moms breastfeeding and pumping to provide it. So I'm going to use this as a platform to extend our support of breastfeeding women around the state. Because of the rural nature of our state, some of that may have to be digital support and telelactation and things along those lines, which is kind of difficult to maneuver, but we're getting better at that thanks to COVID. We've got a lot more resources now that have been developed, so that should help with that too.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Arkansas had a 70% breastfeeding rate among infants born in 2017. Only three states, Alabama, Mississippi, and West Virginia, had lower rates. While there are still a lot of details to work out regarding the development of the state's first breast milk bank, Vermani says she thinks it will be great for Arkansas once it's up and running.
There's big areas of the population that don't have access to healthcare and specifically don't have access to breastfeeding support. And so they don't breastfeed. And that has definitively impacted the health of those communities and their infants, particularly the mothers and infants. And I'm hoping to change that. I've been working on education and teaching and support and outreach my entire time here in Arkansas. But this is a really big step forward in getting the state to commit to breastfeeding's importance to health, and getting UAMS to commit to you know, helping support that even further and reaching out beyond just our borders and going, you know, across the state with the support that we're able to provide.
The state is providing funding for the establishment of the state's first breast milk bank. Vermani says the final number is still being calculated, but the earliest those funds could be released is July 1st. The operating cost as they expand, she says, will go up, so UAMS will likely need to come up with additional funding later on. Vermani is hopeful they'll be ready to start accepting milk by late fall or early spring 2022. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
The Interstate 40 bridge over the Mississippi River connecting West Memphis and Memphis remains closed to vehicles as repairs to a crack in a beam take priority. The closure means congested traffic along the Arkansas-Tennessee border and headaches for logistics professionals and commerce. Roby Brock, with our partner Talk Business and Politics, talked with Shannon Newton, the president of the Arkansas Trucking Association, about just what this closure means for business. She says the bridge represents a major connector, not just for the region, but for the nation.
I think the most simple explanation is time. In any business, time is money. Whether you're talking about idle equipment, burning fuel, or an idle driver, all of those things cost the industry money. And there are opportunity costs that are associated with that. But just the hard cost of sitting idle in traffic. We were able to use some ATRI data. The American Transportation Research Institute has a contract with Federal Highways, and they have GPS systems and trucks throughout the country. And so using that data, we're able to determine that the route that previously took about 8 minutes, which was from the I-40, I-55 interchange west of West Memphis through to Interstate 240 on the Memphis side. So that normally took 8 minutes. In the days immediately following the bridge closure, that was taking 84 minutes. So if you look at just over, 71 minutes, a little bit over an hour taken out of that, the driver's, allowable hours of service, again, the equipment and the fuel. So that the time of sitting idle 71 minutes that was unanticipated is a hard cost. And if you choose to maybe you don't want to sit in traffic for an hour, and so you choose to a different route and you go north through I-555 or south on I-49, then you're looking at, 60 to 100 miles out of route to avoid sitting in that congestion. So whether the cost are congestion or whether they're out of route miles, either way, it's costing the industry at least $2.4 million a day as long as that bridge is closed.
And that will likely get passed on to consumers in the prices that they pay. You met with the feds on Thursday, I believe, in Memphis. What did they say to you? What did you say to them?
Yes, the acting administrator for Federal Highways was in Memphis on Thursday. And I think, the purpose of her trip was to come down and understand better from state, local, officials on the ground, kind of the impact of the bridge to the region. There were also some business leaders that were invited to participate in the meeting. I think it was really to wrap our arms around both some short-term and long-term solutions. It's obvious if I actually went over to Memphis and made the trip. And so it's obvious being there, the impact that it's having on that local community. And that's maybe something I think that has gotten lost. The town of West Memphis is currently gridlocked with traffic using its city streets to try to get, across the river. And so what can be done to alleviate the congestion and the immobility of the area right now? Are there things that Federal Highways can either send extra money and or allow make some allowances or exceptions to create? Can we drive on the shoulder, or do we need to go from two lanes to one lane in this particular situation? Is there anything that we can do to increase capacity as vehicles are trying to use that I-55 bridge? So that was some short-term things that we talked about. How can we get workers who work, on one side of the river but reside on the other side of the river? That's obviously another impact there on the ground. So the purpose of the meeting was to talk about those short-term pains, and if there was anything from the federal perspective, whether it be money or exceptions to existing rules and regulations that would allow any sort of relief to the area. And then on a long-term perspective, I think it was to assure the communities and the people of commerce who were there in the meeting that the federal government is committed to fixing the bridge and reopening it as quickly and as safely as possible.
Any time frame in your estimation as to what it, we might be looking at? I know that's a hard question to ask. I'm not asking you to look into a crystal ball, but I mean, was it discussed?
Yeah, I feel confident in the answer of months. Okay. I think that's based on the conversations that I've been privy to and things that they've said publicly. I believe that there is still some ambiguity in what the actual execution of the solution will be. And so I truly believe at this point that it is still an unknown to some degree.
So I guess last question for you, the trucking industry, at least from my perspective and from my conversations with you over the years, has always been supportive of infrastructure investment. We are having yet again another national debate on infrastructure in Congress. Do you think that this bridge closing down and the way it's impacting the economy, do you think that is going to help hurt, contribute in some way to this infrastructure conversation?
I do think that it elevates the awareness of the issue. And I think that's an important thing. You know, I think the infrastructure network, the supply chain is something that people often take for granted until there's an incident like this, which reminds us that we're all dependent upon it in order to get the things that we want when we want to get them. And so I'm hopeful that this infrastructure debate will be advanced by highlighting what infrastructure really is. You know, you and I, when we say infrastructure, we think about, you know, roads, bridges, broadband. I mean, I hope that this will allow the conversation to advance in a way that allows for some serious conversations and attention to investment from the federal level on things that we traditionally refer to as infrastructure, like the I-40 bridge.
Shannon Newton is the president of the Arkansas Trucking Association. She spoke with Roby Brock, who's with our partner, Talk Business and Politics. You can learn more at talkbusiness.net.
On the final episode of The Movement That Never Was, A People's Guide to Anti-Racism in the South and Arkansas, we look to the future and how building coalitions, even on the smallest level, may be the path forward to true anti-racist work and possibly to healing communities devastated by racism and white supremacy in Arkansas and the South.
How do we love where we come from while at the same time being able to look it straight in the eye and understand exactly what the injustices and struggles are? Like, to be able to hold both of those things at the same time.
The fifth and final episode of The Movement That Never Was, A People's Guide to Anti-Racism in the South and Arkansas, made possible by the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation. Available online right now, anywhere you get your podcasts, and at KUAF.com.
These daily editions of Ozarks at Large also available as a podcast, so you can listen to us when you want to. You can subscribe for free at any of the major podcast distributors. You can also ask your smart speaker to please play Ozarks at Large to hear the most recent daily edition of our program.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is giving away two pairs of tickets to Her Set, Her Sound Music Festival, June 5th, 5 to 11 p.m. at Prairie Street Live in Fayetteville. This event features seven NWA women DJs, dance and entertainment acts, vendors, and more. Winners will be announced this Friday, May 28th, during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Registration and information available at KUAF.com. Anyone interested in the Farm School for Beginning Farmer is invited to an open house at the Center for Arkansas Farms and Food. This event, June 5th from 1:30 to 3:30, features a guided tour, program information, and small bites of the harvest prepared by local chefs. Registration is required. NWAFarmEvents.org for more information.
This is Ozarks at Large. Earlier this month, the CDC announced that fully vaccinated people no longer need to wear masks or physically distance. For restaurants and diners, that could mean a steady return to business as usual. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth recently spoke with Neil Gray, the executive chef of The Preacher's Son in Bentonville, about taking on that position during the pandemic and how his restaurant is slowly easing restrictions.
All right, Neil. Well, can you tell me a little bit about how the past few months have been starting a new job as the head chef during kind of a weird time during a pandemic?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it was a very weird time to start a new job as the head chef. I was living in New York at the time, and I was kind of like feeling out some opportunities here in Bentonville from my apartment in Brooklyn. And I had never really thought about working for the Preacher's Son and didn't really know a lot about rope swing at the time. I was really kind of like feeling out the opportunities for kind of like doing my own thing. But the more I got to know rope swing and the more I got to see what they were doing in this area, the more interested I became. And eventually I made my way down here in August and met some of the executives, and the job sort of came around, and I ended up relocating here in December, and the pandemic was still very much a thing. The restaurant was very slow at the time. People were very weary about coming out, and it's kind of a drag for a restaurant. Restaurants are a place that are supposed to feel convivial and exciting, and it's not a lot of fun to go in and know that you're going to cook for a few people. So I think the challenge there is to continue doing your best work for the people that are coming out, to make sure that everyone feels safe in their environment, and to try to keep spirits as high as possible. And I think that's kind of where we were in the winter when I started. And now things are very different. The restaurant has picked up a lot. So we kind of went from zero to 100 in that regard. So it's been pretty interesting. Now it kind of feels like we're playing a lot of catch up.
Yeah. And what was that kind of transition like from being so slow and people being a bit wary of coming back to now having more people in? You know, what's the mood of diners and then also, you know, your staff?
Well, our staff has always been great. They've always been very, very willing to come out and of course, follow the safety guidelines themselves and keep themselves as safe as possible. But also at the same time, you know, coming out and being in this environment where they know that they could potentially become infected, because you never know what's going to happen when a pandemic is circulating. But they've always been giving and willing and generous in that regard to do what was best for themselves and for the restaurant, which was amazing. And I think from the guest perspective, I mean, especially now with the CDC removing a lot of the mask guidelines, with cases being down in all 50 states for the first time, the diners, I think, feel a lot more comfortable at this point. We still have a lot of distance in our dining room, and we're fortunate in that regard that it's a big open space, so no one is too close together from separate parties, you know. But the diners, I think, are definitely beginning to relax, and I think you can see it everywhere.
Yeah, and I want to go back and talk, you know, about your move to Arkansas. So you're from Arkansas originally.
Correct. I grew up in a town called Malvern, Arkansas, very near Hot Springs.
And so what was the decision to decide to move back and to work for a restaurant here?
I'd always looked to cultivate skills in a lot of different markets. You know, I worked in New York for a long time, in California, Vegas, and had really committed myself to just cooking for a long time. Yeah. And going to some of the restaurants that I thought were some of the better restaurants here in America, and cultivating the skill with the hope that one day I could bring it back home and find an audience that would really appreciate it and enjoy it. And I think the timing felt right. I had been away from home for about 20 years. And I think, if, you know, with the pandemic coming around and my restaurant in New York closing, it just felt like the right time to try something new and to come back home.
And I'm sure that, you know, the dining scene and restaurant culture here has probably changed a lot from when you grew up in Malvern. You know, when you think of food or dining or cuisine in this region, you know, what comes to mind and how are you incorporating that into the menus that you're putting together for the Preacher's Son?
Well, you know, I'm still learning more and more about what people like to eat in this area, the way that they like to dine, and trying to incorporate that more and more into, you know, the food that we present and the way that we present it as well. I like to keep our food here very approachable. So, you know, if we're doing like a strawberry salad or something like that, we want to have something that makes it relatable, but also creative, unique, and beautiful, if that makes sense. If we're doing something like chicken and dumplings, it's going to be like a play on it. It's going to be something fun where somebody can look at it and they can say, oh, this is like a dumpling with chickens, but it's not the chicken and dumplings that I grew up eating. So we always want to have things on the menu that people can relate to, but at the same time, be excited about it. And I think that's a fun way to keep diners engaged.
Yeah, any specific ingredients or products that you're kind of excited about using or featuring this time of year?
Yeah, right now we're playing with Magara strawberries, which are great. And in the springtime, strawberries are obviously something to get really excited about. So we're kind of game planning dishes with that. I recently went out to Hannah Family Ranch and met Will and Waltina. And springtime is always a great time to serve lamb. So there's a lot of exciting spring in the air, you know. Lettuce heads at the market, spring onions, asparagus, all those beautiful spring items that you wait all winter for.
And then, you know, also right now is a pretty tough time for a lot of restaurants. You know, the pandemic, the restrictions are opening up, but with that, you know, a lot of places are starting to feel kind of the ripple effects of the economy. You know, meat prices are going up. There's a worker shortage. Is that something that you were facing and dealing with at the Preacher's Son?
Yeah, the worker shortages are always the thing that we deal with, mm-hmm. in the restaurants. It seems like we deal with it in any market, regardless of where you are, yeah. whether it's in Bentonville, Arkansas, or, you know, Manhattan, New York. And we're definitely short right now. So anybody who's interested in coming up to the Preacher's Son, I think you should do it. We've got a lot to offer. So yeah. All of you young cooks listening out there, line up at this door, because we're interested in meeting you. And then as far as food shortages go, food supplies, you know, the increase in meat that you're referring to, I think what we always try to do here is we try to work as hard as we can to keep our inventory in line and keep our costs in line, so that whenever we have an increase in a raw material like meat or something like that we don't have to pass so much of it on to the guests. And I'm always very, very conscious of that. And I look hard at numbers and I say, you know, where can we make the margins that we need to make, and at the same time, make sure that our guests are getting great value. And I think that's the balance right there, is finding the margin that you need, and at the same time, providing your guests with value.
And then I'm just wondering, you know, if you were to go back to Brooklyn or to California or to anywhere that you had worked previously and tell someone, you know, this is what the food culture or the cuisine or what it is like to work at a restaurant or cook food in Northwest Arkansas, this region, how would you describe it? What would you say to them?
It's interesting. I think there's like a lot of Southern spirit here. In our dining room, people love to come out and they love to eat in large groups, and like they want to sit down and they want to have fun. They want to order a lot of food, and it's sort of like, it's almost like the way that you would think of like Sunday supper, you know, growing up as a kid, when you have like your family there and everyone is in good spirits. And I think I see a lot of that in the dining room. Whereas like in New York, you know, we tend to be like a lot of two tops, a lot of dates, a lot of, you know, a lot of business. I think there's a real like Southern spirit in this dining room. And I think a real camaraderie in the kitchen. And, you know, a lot of my cooks, they've grown up knowing each other their entire lives. And, you know, they knew each other when they were kids. They've gone to school together. They've graduated. Now they're here and they're learning how to be chefs. And I can appreciate the fact that, you know, my cooks are so close. And, you know, maybe that adds to their work experience with one another.
And then as people start to go out to restaurants more, start to patronize places, what advice or, you know, information should they know to keep themselves, to keep other diners and workers safe?
Get vaccinated. Yeah. Get vaccinated. You know, get those two shots in you and give it the 3 weeks to build your antibodies up. And then, you know, from there, just take your standard safety guidelines. You know, wash your hands, wear your mask when you go until you get to your table. And then, you know, from there, enjoy yourselves. But I think the key to going out and feeling safe in restaurants is to take those two shots. You know, the restaurants really miss their guests. And, you know, we want to see everyone come back and we want to see everyone have a great time.
All right. Well, thanks for talking to me, Neil.
Hey, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much. I appreciate your time.
That was Neil Gray, executive chef of The Preacher's Son in Bentonville, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth. Daniel's stories are created inside the Karen Taha News Studio. Thanks for being with us for this Monday edition of Ozarks at Large. The Creative Community Center in downtown Fayetteville is also figuring its way in a post-vaccine environment. Last week, Bryce Briscoe, the senior director of studio programs at the center, came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. He says the pottery, painting, and other studios at the center are emerging from a quiet 14 months and ready to host visitors of all artistic levels once again.
Coming out of the pandemic, we've expanded our offerings. So the classes we were offering in April, we had five class offerings. In March, we offered 38, and that's a range of classes from pottery to hand building. We're offering incense making. We have painting with Kathy Thompson. We have abstract figure drawing with Sean Fitzgibbon. We have a date night every Friday and Saturday night, so you can come in, spend some quality time with your significant other on the wheel. That's a great deal, very popular. popular. We also have youth classes in the afternoon. We're offering glass fusing, macrame. We're running a knot tying class, which might be interesting, a little bit different. And then we also have summer camps. So our summer camp will start on June 7th and run through July 23rd. It's Monday through Friday, and it's for children ages 7 to 12. And this year we're doing it a bit differently. We have four rotations of art, craft, theater, and dance.
I'm going to ask about some of these classes. There was a term in there, I think, right after you said pottery, hand building?
Hand building. So it's more like clay sculpture.
So pottery, generally, it's the wheel?
Correct, correct.
Hand building, no wheel?
No wheel. So this would be, and all our classes, for the most part, are designed for beginners. So anyone can come in off the street if they're curious, if they want to just try their hand at it. They can get their hands in some clay or take a painting class. We offer printmaking, drawing, and we have almost all our classes geared for beginners.
Glass fusing, I heard you say. What in the world is glass fusing?
So glass fusing is great for beginners to come in and try using glass as a medium where you're using different colored glass. You're layering it. We then put that into the kiln, and it melts it all into a single cohesive piece of glass. So it's like making sun catchers and things like that. We're also looking forward to offering a stained glass class later this summer.
Often these classes will be in different studios, but simultaneous, right?
Correct, correct. We have usually a class going on in each studio. So we have four studios. We have the ceramic studio. We have a small craft studio, which is where things like glass fusing and macrame would happen. We have a painting studio and then also a drawing studio.
So if you're in the hall, right, the studios are on the left and the right of you, you're in the hall at one of those peak times, what does it sound like?
There could be a lot going on in there. There might be some music playing. You'll definitely hear the wheels spinning and people chatting. But for the most part, art's a fairly quiet practice. So people are usually head down and sort of concentrating and building skills and having a good time. In the hallway, to speak of the hallway, that is actually the McCoy Gallery, and we will be having a closing reception for Terry Simler and Michael Gorey's show. That'll be on June 4th from 6 to 8 p.m.
How do people – you say it's for beginners, so there's really no excuse, right? I mean, if you've ever been interested, so how do you sign up?
You can find us on Instagram or Facebook at Community Creative Center. You can check out our website. It's constantly being updated. We're constantly adding new classes, new series. We're adding retreats, and that is www.communitycreativecenter.org. We're at 505 West Spring Street. You can give us a call at 479-571-2706. And Maria and Denise will be happy to help you.
We're in an interesting time, right? I mean, the CDC has said you don't need masks in most situations. Some of us are vaccinated, some are not. How are you managing all of that in a still uncertain time?
We're still taking all the necessary safety precautions. We're very fortunate to have a very large studio, so people can be spaced out. We keep our teacher-to-student ratio fairly low, and we're still asking that people wear masks as they feel comfortable. All of our teaching staff and facility staff are fully vaccinated.
You're an artist.
I am. I'm a potter.
Are you still able to do work while being a program director?
A bit, yes. I still teach. I still keep my hands in it, and I have a hand definitely in the day-to-day goings-on of the studio, and that's really where my heart and soul is. And I would say that about our entire staff as well as our board, which is fantastic. They are all deeply invested in the arts and dedicated to the arts, and I would say everyone there has some experience in the arts. So it's really art-driven from the core.
Who's teaching the knot-tying class?
That is actually Peter Marsh, local celebrity. Peter Marsh of Marsh Tree Service. He is a certified arborist and rock climber, and I think he knows about everybody in town. It's going to be a really fun class and a little something different for us. We're just trying some different things coming out of the pandemic to give the community a place to go, spend some time, socialize with a purpose, and to start to get out again.
And finally, one very silly question for a potter. Do you wish the movie Ghost had never existed? Because it seems like everyone, when they think of the potting wheel now, they think of Patrick Swayze and Demi Moore.
Nothing against the filmmakers, but if I had a time machine, that would probably be in the top 10 things I would go back and erase from history as a Potter, yes.
Bryce Briscoe is the Senior Director of Studio Programs at the Community Creative Center in Fayetteville. He spoke with us at our studio last week. You can learn more at communitycreativecenter.org.
Do you still feel for your life? Do you have any questions, Mr. Walker? Any comments?
Have you been told not to call?
Have you been told not to say anything? How do you feel about being back in the state of Arkansas?
I don't know. I'd rather be in Philadelphia.
That will be explained in just a minute. First, let me welcome Randy Dixon from the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History into the studio.
My goodness. It's nice to see your face.
Ditto. And we haven't done this face-to-face in a long time.
Oh, well, more than a year.
Yeah. And we're both fully vaccinated?
Yes.
So
bulletproof?
Well,
maybe.
Yes. And for this sort of restart of our face-to-face conversations for Pryor Center Profiles, we're going to have a conclusion.
Yes, we're finally going to wrap up the saga of James Dean Walker.
Our story thus far?
Well, he was a two-time convicted cop killer who escaped and was caught out west in Nevada. And
after 4 years.
Yes, he had been on the lam for 4 years. And, well, actually, Jim Pitcock can kind of summarize the whole thing in this report. When he went out to Nevada right after James Dean Walker was captured and had this exclusive report for KATV.
Walker was arrested in September for selling drugs. During a routine fingerprint check, police determined Walker, who had identified himself as James Bennett Simpson, was actually an escapee from the Arkansas prison convicted of killing North Little Rock policeman Gerald Vaughn in 1963. Walker escaped from Arkansas in 1975 after failing to return from a furlough at Wynn. Instead, he had gone to Memphis, caught a plane, and flew to California. He settled in this resort community several months later. He worked at a shoe repair shop less than a mile from the county sheriff's office. He would often go to San Francisco, however. He says he was never recognized.
It's Jim Pitcock, longtime reporter and news director for KATV, talking about this James Dean Walker saga. They find him in Nevada. There's the extradition process. Finally, he is back in Arkansas.
Yes, he was fighting it for about 2 months. And was unsuccessful, as Jim Pitcock predicted. Mm. And yes, he was extradited to Arkansas.
I hope nothing happens. No one's mistreated me at all since I've been back these past 4 days. I'm at the Pine Bluff unit, and everyone there has treated me very fairly. Mr. Dobbs assures me that no one's going to bother me, and at this point I have to be willing to accept his assurances.
So, as you can imagine, here you have a twice convicted, once sentenced to death escapee back in the state. Mm-hmm. This is a huge, huge story.
Oh, it did. And it was a media circus. Reporter for KATV Randy Weber has this stand-up report.
James Dean Walker's stay here in Pine Bluff will be indefinite. Prison officials will not say when he'll be transferred back to the Cummins unit, but Mr. Griffin says once he's transferred back, the man that generated so much publicity will be treated like any other inmate. This is Randy Weber in Pine Bluff reporting for News Scene 7.
It's not quite over, though, is it, this whole story, just because he's back, he's been extradited back to Arkansas?
Right, right. He's wanting a third trial. And here is a it was such a big deal that KATV would interrupt programming whenever there was some sort of development in the case.
Mr. Walker, on the third trial, keeping in mind that you had two already, what are you hoping for? What main bit of evidence that could
I can't
examine?
Comment on this. You have to talk this over with the lawyers. We've got a mountain of evidence right now that could exonerate me. And so you'll have to discuss this with the attorneys.
Without being specific, what area are you looking at?
evidence that had been tampered with and altered, perjured testimony given, bias and prejudice by the trial judge, witnesses intimidated. You can just about dig into the pile and pull out anything you want. There were 59 errors in my last conviction, so this gives you a little bit of an idea of what we're looking at. But talk to the attorneys about that.
Of course, this is still well before even cable television's sort of influence into the ratings or the viewership. I mean, everyone was still watching broadcast local news for
right.
information.
And it had to be a pretty big deal if you're going to interrupt one life to live or something like that.
Right.
And KTV was serious enough about news that we wouldn't hesitate to interrupt programming. We would get some calls, you know,
sure.
but we thought it was important enough. And it did go before the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. And again, we interrupt programming, and here's Steve Barnes and Amy Oliver.
The following is a special bulletin from News Scene 7.
Good morning. A new trial, a third trial. James Dean Walker will be tried once again or be set free by order of the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. An opinion handed down just moments ago from the nine judges of the appeals court says that Mr. Walker should be given a third trial for the 1963 murder of a North Little Rock policeman or be set free within 60 days. News Scene's Amy Oliver is standing by at the federal courthouse at Little Rock. Amy?
Steve, we're still trying to decipher this 54-page opinion, but the most important part comes on page 36, and we'll quote the judges here. Accordingly, we conclude that James Dean Walker is entitled to habeas corpus relief, a new trial, and later on in the opinion it says that trial shall be granted within 60 days. It was believed that Justice Richard Arnold of Little Rock would be the swing vote, so to speak, on the final decision here, and he was. He has a separate opinion, which we have not been able to go through. In the majority opinion, he has concluded affirmed the majority, and we have, as I said, not been able to read all of it through completely yet, but the decision again, 5-4.
So, wow, a third trial. I mean, we once convicted, twice convicted, and now a third trial.
Yes, and it's been more than two decades.
Yeah, since the crime.
Right. So, you know, what happens to evidence? What happens to witnesses? It's a little tough to try. And I think Deborah Mathis, who was a reporter for Channel 7, really summed things up. But he was let free. He did not stand trial again.
By the time James Dean Walker went free on Election Day, the storms of protest had calmed to a drizzle. Chris Piazza, the man who would have prosecuted Walker a third time, had reluctantly accepted what time had done, wilted away the evidence, the witnesses, and their recollections he needed to make a conviction of murder against Walker. Time had taken its toll on Maida Vaughn, too. It had been 23 and a half years since her husband, North Little Rock patrolman Gerald Vaughn, was fatally shot on the Old England Highway near North Little Rock in the pre-dawn hours of April 16, 1963. The 22-year-old Walker had been passing through town with the older Russell Compey, an Arkansas native just out of prison. The two got into a fracas at a local bar, fled in a rented car, were pulled over by police. Patrolman Gene Barentine frisked Compey. Vaughn approached Walker on the passenger side. There was gunfire. Walker was shot five times. Vaughn shot once in the heart. When Walker came to in the hospital a few days later, he was charged with first-degree murder. Compey was never charged in that case, but went to prison later for something else. For years, the theory was whispered about that Barentine had accidentally shot his partner in a panic. Barentine had emptied his gun on the scene, and those rumors were fueled when it was learned that Barentine had sawed off the barrel of his gun before it was run through ballistics tests. Walker's claim of innocence was buttressed by the condition of the gun he had with him that night. It was fully loaded. But police claimed he used a second gun to kill Vaughn, a police prototype found beneath the car. Walker maintained he had only one gun. Walker was convicted in 1964 and sentenced to die by electrocution. He got a second trial the next year and was given life in prison. While at Tucker Prison, Walker kept a clean record, won furlough rights, and used his free time speaking in churches to raise money for a chapel, the first ever built on an Arkansas prison compound. His applications for parole were countered by intensive police protests. Time after time, he was turned down. Then in 1975, denied parole again, Walker went on furlough one weekend and kept going to California. 4 years later, he was arrested there on a drug charge. Despite his alias, fingerprints identified him as the Arkansas escapee. He lost a two-year fight against extradition, but eventually won transfer to a federal prison near Oklahoma City, claiming that prison official Art Lockhart had threatened to kill him. Then, in February 1984, a diary kept by Russell Compey in prison was discovered by Compey's ex-wife. In it, Compey indicates he may have fired the shot that killed Officer Vaughn. That brought Walker a new hearing in federal court. Now he had an army of supporters, a battery of lawyers, and the new evidence, the Compey diary, and a newly discovered transcript of a secretly recorded conversation between Compey and his now-deceased sister, in which he again indicates he fired some shots that night in 1963. Unhappy with the federal order for a new trial after so many years, the state's attorney general and prosecutor Piazza vowed to prosecute. In the meantime, they agreed to give Walker his first taste of legitimate freedom by allowing him to make bond and wait for his trial in Nevada, where he had lived and worked during his escape time. A few days before Walker's third trial was to have begun, prosecuting and defense attorneys worked out a plea bargain. Walker pleaded guilty to manslaughter by vicarious liability, meaning he accepted responsibility for Vaughn's death, though maintained he didn't shoot him. And it was over. It took 23 minutes to end a case that spanned 23 years.
There are some minor similarities to this case in the West Memphis 3, in a way.
Yes, that's true, because he did end up pleading guilty.
Right.
Sort of without pleading guilty.
Right.
But he, you know, time served, and he was released. I did get to talk to Chris Piazza, who at the time was the prosecutor. Now he's a retired judge, but mm-hmm. I talked to him about it, and he was kind of between a rock and a hard place. He had almost an impossible task, and this is kind of what he said about it.
From the evidence we had, and you can't try a case 20 years later without evidence. I mean, it was an impossibility, and I thought that was the best thing that we could do, is to get him to plead guilty to the manslaughter and send him out to his folks in California that loved him.
That's Chris Piazza, who had the difficult job of prosecuting a 20-year-old case with evidence that wasn't still around.
Well, and he said it was a really tough decision to make, especially because the officer's widow was still alive.
Yeah.
And he had some long discussions with her about it, and she understood.
So what happened to James Dean Walker?
Well, that's the big question. I was talking to Mike Masterson, mm-hmm. the columnist and investigative reporter. He thinks he may have just gone on back out to California or gone to the East Coast, but he thinks he died just of natural causes.
Well, he would be. I mean,
yeah.
Because, I mean, the crime itself was in the 1960s.
Right. So he would be in his 70s or 80s.
Yeah, depending on, yeah. Well, I've said this before about this case. It's interesting to me how big a deal it was then and how little many of us remember about it now.
Right. And it was at the beginning of my broadcast career when he was captured out in Nevada, and right. I'd never heard of him.
Yeah.
Because it had been 4 years before that he had escaped, and then even long, I was 4 years old when he was convicted of the murder.
Right.
So it was ancient history then. So it was really interesting to go through and dig up all of this material.
Well, the benefit of history is you can put this 30-plus-year saga you know, into one place.
Right.
And have all the details from the initial shootout to the questioning whether it was his gun that was responsible for the murder, all the way up to that bizarre sort of third trial.
Right.
That didn't really
take place. Took us four parts.
Exactly, exactly. So now we'll move on. Any idea, and it's okay if you don't, what we'll talk about next Monday?
No idea.
That's fine. Randy Dixon is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. You can spend so much time finding out about Arkansas history by putting Pryor Center into a search engine. Randy, as always, thank you and welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be here in person.
Does Neptune have rings? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto manager with NASA Goddard, and this is Scratching the Surface. Neptune does indeed have rings, but certainly not as spectacular as Saturn and Uranus. Instead, the rings of Neptune are very faint and dusty. There are five main rings, first discovered in 1984 at the La Silla Observatory in Chile, then eventually imaged by the Voyager 2 spacecraft in 1989. Neptune's rings are named after the astronomers who contributed to the studies of Neptune. These are Galilei, Le Verrier, LaSalle, Arago, and Adams. The rings of Neptune are very dark, likely irradiated methane that has been compounded into hydrocarbons. This similar process is also found in the rings of Uranus. Also, these rings have gaps in between, and what resides in these gaps are moons, called shepherd moons, where shepherd moons essentially gravitationally control the dust and ice rings into circular orbits around Neptune. Such ring systems and their interactions with tiny moons still provides plenty of questions about Neptune and the ring systems, such as, how did the rings originate? Why are Uranus and Neptune's rings darker compared to Jupiter and Saturn? And do the ice from the shepherd moons interact with the rings, or vice versa? For more segments of Scratching the Surface, visit KUAF.com.
The KUAF Pluto manager, Caitlin Ahrens, studied space and planetary sciences at the University of Arkansas. She's currently a postdoctoral researcher at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. Scratching the Surface is a production of KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville, Arkansas.
On tomorrow's Ozarks at Large, a seasoned Ozarks farmer is spurring a new hemp industry in northwest Arkansas. Jacqueline Froelich will give us that report. Plus, the militant grammarian is back for a new visit to talk about language and much more. Tuesday, Ozarks at Large, tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m. on KUAF.
The Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society and the KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series presents Jazz in Bloom with the Claudia Burson Quintet and the Northwest Arkansas Jazz Youth Ensemble Quartet, Sunday, June 6th from 6:30 to 8:30 at Botanical Garden of the Ozarks. Tickets and information are available at digjazz.com. Support for KUAF comes from the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal, now featuring technology and telecoms, plus local business news from Northwest Arkansas. Subscriptions and information available at 725-0394 or nwabusinessjournal.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Bella Vista. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to this Monday edition of our show included Antoinette Grajeda, Daniel Carruth, and Roby Brock from our partner Talk Business and Politics. Timothy Dennis produced our show next door in the Herald and Blanchcock News Studio. Scratching the Surface is written and hosted by Dr. Caitlin Ahrens, and it's produced by Pete Hartman. Our theme is titled First Hurrah. It's written and performed by Daryl Sean. Additional content for today's show provided by our colleagues at KASU Radio in Jonesboro. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with what's happening across the region and around the state of Arkansas every weekday morning at 5:30 and 7:30 with Antoinette Grajeda's newscast Inside Morning Edition. You can find out much more about us at our website, ozarksatlarge.com. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for being with us this Monday. Let's make this a good week. Take care of yourself. We'll talk again very soon.